You ready for some coffee, honey?
Absolutely.
I'll pour.
Great coffee. I'm Dr. Ron Martinelli.
And I'm Linda Martinelli.
And we are talking
while married.
So Dr. Ron and Linda back on the road from Texas to California for a couple of weeks of business. And I want to talk about immigration because we saw some interesting and unfortunate things on this trip out to California, especially going through the border states.
Okay, let's do it.
Well, let's start with what's happening on the border. I think everybody has been talking about it, not as much on the mainstream media, but certainly more conservative stations, Fox and the radio stations and things like that have been discussing the significant immigration crisis at the border with hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens breaching our country's southern border. And the thing that I noticed, which was quite remarkable, was that the Customs and Border Enforcement stations and entry points along the way that we passed, going through Texas and New Mexico and Arizona, were closed down. And I've never seen that before. They were literally closed down.
Yes.
So where did those guys go?
Well, they went to the border to help with humanitarian needs because we are so flooded with people that they needed to call in every body that they could to help.
But, you know, the problem with that is the Customs and Border Protection agents are not trained for humanitarian efforts. They are law enforcement officers. They don't know anything about taking care of families, about triage, you know, medical triage. Do kids have diseases? Do families have diseases? Do they have this? Do they have that? Do they have food? Do they have shelter? Do they have water? How long can they keep them in detention? All of these things, these officers are well trained, but they don't teach them that at the federal academies.
No, and you know, the only one that was open, but I'm not sure that it was a border station or if it was agricultural. It may have been agricultural.
It was agricultural.
California.
Yeah, no, it was agricultural.
Here's what's funny is that they're going to make sure that we don't bring any fruit into the state, but you can bring
boatloads
of illegal aliens.
And drugs,
yeah,
into the state.
Right.
But watch out, you might have a fruit fly or a tainted avocado. But I just thought it was fascinating. And we had seen a story on Fox News about the small town of Deming, New Mexico. And this is a town, what, Linda, did they say about 20, 30,000 people?
Yes.
It sure looked like it was less than that when we were there.
Well, it generally is less than that. It's grown quite a bit.
Well,
in fact,
yeah,
a lot of those towns, just as an aside, have grown lately because a lot of their workers are going out to the pipeline
the pipeline that's going through the states. And we saw a lot of that in Texas. We actually did get our first look at the pipeline. It's not a huge pipeline, right? In other words, the pipe is not huge.
No, it's
only
huge.
About like 3 or 4 feet in diameter at best.
And you know, I mean, my first thought is, wow, there was all this fighting in the Obama administration about that, like some huge ecological problem with that. I mean, it's as big around as about maybe a tire.
I think they built a trench that was about 8 feet in diameter, and it's only a few feet under the ground. Not very much. It's just a few feet under the ground, maybe 4 feet under the ground. And the pipe, like I said, looked to be like a 3 or 4 foot diameter pipe. So you've got, you know, down about 4 feet, 2 feet on other side. And once it's covered over, you would never even know it's there because it's out there in kind of more like the desert and the scrub and the cacti and things like that. I mean, there is not disturbing anything. But
no,
I want to get... But
and
I
there's
wanna...
portions of it, too, that are above ground.
Yeah. But
yeah.
I didn't see any. Did
yeah,
you see the
I,
part
oh, yeah,
that
I
was
did.
Above ground?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I didn't see that part. But you and I were so intrigued with the story about Deming that we went to the city and spoke with police officers there.
Right.
All right. And they were very professional. They told us they couldn't talk very much about it, but they said that the city is engaged in assisting customs with the humanitarian effort. They said the city has really pitched in with the different service organizations and churches and trying to get these people food. And I said, how did y'all feel about all of a sudden them dumping several hundred illegal aliens on you? Were you notified? They said, oh, we were told. They were kind of told at the last minute. But I said, so what do you do? They said, well, we get our different groups together and we clothe them and we feed them. And I said, well, are they under detention? Because they're here illegally, are they under detention? And the officers said, no. And I said, so they're free to walk away at any time they want. And the officer said, yes. So obviously they're not under detention. And I said, what happens when they walk away? And they said, well, they just go wherever the heck they're going. And then we get another couple of hundred more to take their place.
Right. Or they also said that a lot of them come back. So they have they have a shelter for them. So whether it's a big tent shelter or what, we didn't go
see
it.
We didn't ask that.
So, but they do have a shelter for them. They do have a place for them to stay and be secure in. And, you know, they actually have a really, really nice attitude in that town. And for people who've never been to Deming, it's one of those towns that's literally out in the middle of nowhere. It's a small town that sits in the middle of the desert. And there's nothing around it. So there's not the next town that you can walk to. You know, you can't just, you know, go across a city line or something.
Well, I think the next town is about 60 miles away, maybe Lordsburg or, you know, some place like that. But this is an agricultural town. So there is nothing out there but agriculture and the support services and people like that. I don't want to offend the city council at Deming, but it seems that the town is somewhat impoverished. Would you not agree?
Yes, I would agree.
All right. And so, I mean, I think my point is the town is already hurting. They have 30 officers for their population, which actually, you know, one or more officers, 1.5 officers, or a little bit less than that per 1,000 capita, which actually is good. And the officers we met were very professional. I will tell you that they were well equipped. They had everything that they needed to have, and they enjoyed their jobs. But because now they have these unexpected illegal aliens in their town, several hundred, they are spending time actually overtime,
right.
All right? So it's affecting the manpower such that they have to spend, the city has to spend overtime hours, right, to you know, pay for these officers to do their jobs. And, you know, my question was, and of course they weren't able to answer it, and I understand it, it's an administrative question actually, is the federal government going to reimburse these cities and counties when we are using law enforcement personnel to do humanitarian efforts that they're not trained nor equipped for?
Yeah, and I pretty much promise you that answer is no. But what has happened in that community, which is really not what I was expecting, wasn't expecting anything one way or the other, is that that community feels that these illegal immigrants are here, and it is what it is, and they have stepped up to feed them and give them clothing. And these are people that don't have a lot of that themselves.
That's a good point that you raised, because they really, like I said, it's not a wealthy community by any stretch of the imagination. We drove down some of the side streets, and we saw what I would say is, I think, a significant level of poverty in that town.
But you know what we didn't see, Ron? We didn't see homeless encampments there.
No, you didn't, because it's sort of an inhospitable area for homeless people. I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, you're out there in the scrub. It's a dusty town. During the summertime, you know, we've been there
during the summertime.
It's hot as Hades. You know, we're talking well into triple digits. And I think that that's sort of a kind of a desolate place to be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But the people there are very nice people.
Yes, and very nice.
They really stepped up, and they did what communities across the country used to do and should do. And I was very heartwarmed by that because it's kind of the way it was when I grew up. You know, that this is what communities and churches and organizations did for people. The fact that they are not, you know, they're not angry, they're not, they're not out protesting, even though this burden has been dropped on them that they didn't ask for, and it's a town that can ill afford it, really.
Well, yeah, and I want to return back to the law enforcement resources and go back to the federal resources, because we've spent tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, probably more accurate, to build and equip and man these control stations, these border control stations, these entry point stations, these inspection stations. And, you know, Linda, we have been doing this for quite some time, and it's a very interesting thing. If people haven't been through one of the border control stations, you are going through, I mean, the technology, the electronics, the enforcement is really something. They stop every car and truck that's going through there. And as you go through, they make you slow your speed down to just a few miles an hour, and you are going past sniffing machines, infrared machines, X-ray machines, everything possible to see what's inside your vehicle. And then you're stopping, and there's a drug detection dog, or there's an explosive detection dog, you know, working the front, and they're questioning you and trying to figure out who you are. And I've always felt that that is a necessary thing, and it's a good thing for us because it protects us from human traffickers and drug traffickers and illegal alien coyotes and just all measure of things. But now there is nobody there.
No.
Okay? And so we are not being protected, and our tax money was going to pay for that, and now it's been diverted. And I tell you what, I am extremely angry, and I feel so bad for those men and women in Customs and Border Protection, because they are very frustrated that they cannot protect this nation. And, you know, the sheriffs of these border counties are pissed off because the federal agents that have gone to help them in their drug trafficking task force and some of these HIDTA task forces are gone. And so you get these smaller, deserty border counties that may only have a handful of deputies in a task force, and they really depend on the federal government and the federal agents to support those efforts to stop drugs and sex trafficking rings, you know, the cartels and everything. And now all these people are gone. They've abandoned these task forces to go, you know, work on humanitarian things. That's not what they're there for.
No, and one other interesting thing about Deming was that the majority of their crime happens to be drugs, not drug dealing, but drug users.
And burglary, because of drug users. So when we are not stopping the flow of drugs into the United States, how does that go and help the problem with respect to dealing with drug abuse? It doesn't help it at all. It makes it so much worse.
And it does. And what happens is you get impoverished towns like this because the people just are unable to work, and they're unable to really function because their whole function in life is that next fix. And, you know, since heroin has made a big comeback in this country and we still have a lot of meth, those are just really drugs that disable you from being able to have a functioning, healthy life.
Okay. And today I had to go down to San Diego. I had to go down to Oceanside. And of course, we used to have a ranch in Temecula, and one of our big border control checkpoints inland is right there in Rainbow. on the Highway 15. And that is closed down equally. So here's something that you probably don't know. Yesterday, the DEA recovered in Apple Valley, which is San Bernardino County, so they had to come up through that way.
Yes.
Okay, 500 pounds of methamphetamine and an ounce of fentanyl, which is...
enough to kill a city, probably.
Pretty close. I would say a small city, 10, 15, 20,000 people, mm-hmm. kill them all. All right? 1 ounce of fentanyl. So they recovered 500 pounds of meth, huge amount of meth, and then the fentanyl and a bunch of weapons. Why did those drugs get into this country? And because, guess what? Our Border Patrol offices and our checkpoints are closed, and they're working on humanitarian efforts that we did not create. This is the creation of Congress, and they need to own it, and both sides need to own it.
Well, and that's exactly right. And what when you say that this is, you know, the problem because the border stations are closed, that's a symptom of it for sure. But the problem is... our politicians. That is the problem. Number one problem. They have created this mess, and they have created many more messes, but they've created this mess. And this is a whole stubbornness and a get Trump kind of mess. And it's also a power, money and power mess. And they have created it for all of us by telling us that we are terrible people because we don't feel so bad for these people coming over the border.
And there is no crisis.
Yeah, there's no crisis. Okay. We have no heart. These poor people just want asylum. I'm sorry, BS. That is BS. And we deserve, as American citizens, to be protected in this country from these drugs, from
the sex trafficking rings, from the drug trafficking rings, from the cartels, from the MS-13, from terrorists that are sneaking into this country, going through the porous border. We need to be protected from all of these things, and we're not.
And from people that are illegally voting, and from people that are living on our doorsteps, all of those things. One thing that we noticed, Ron, for sure, when we drove this time was... a lot of homeless people, and a lot of people, of course, that corridor tends to be that way anyway, but not with encampments or anything like that. But here's what I notice, that when you give people an inch, you know, they take a mile, right? And when one of the things that we tend to do at times is we'll stay in Walmart parking lots if we need to get some sleep. And there's a Walmart there. They're very kind. They have security. They have lights. The store's open all night. And they welcome truckers and they welcome RVs. Well, this time, what was really interesting is instead of just RVs, and all the RVs are out of there early in the morning, there are people now that are taking advantage of Walmarts.
In their hospitality.
And they are making themselves a homeless encampment there, with trashy trailers that obviously can't even move. You couldn't move them if you wanted to. And they're filthy and they're littered, and they're making that typical homeless encampment scenario. What is being done about that? Because first of all, they're going to ruin it for everybody.
It is. And you know what? The mentality is disgraceful of those homeless people, because as you know, Walmart does a phenomenal job to try to help all of the people that are RVers and people like us. And they put trash cans all over the place, okay, because they keep a very clean grounds. Did you notice when we left that a couple of the homeless cars, and you could tell they just had blankets over them and everything. You could tell there were people living in their cars. And then the one guy that had the RV and then the trailer that he couldn't pull, he's trying to make a compound there. But when the other people left, they left all their trash on the ground. Did you see that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They had trash cans within easily walking distance, 40 yards away. And they didn't do that. Instead, they just left all their trash.
Yeah, they threw everything out of their car.
And when you see the other RV people, like us, when we leave, you can't even tell we were ever there.
Right.
Okay? And that's just the kind of mentality and the people we're dealing with. How about a cup of coffee?
The Out Loud perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Well, would you agree that homeless tent cities are pretty lawless?
Oh, I would definitely agree that. I mean, as a former law dog, I had to work a lot around homeless encampments and deal with all of the crime and the filth and the disease and the mental health issues and, you know, all of that that comes with homeless encampments.
Well, there are, yeah, a ton of problems with them. And, you know, we've really, really enabled these in this country. And, you know, it's really become a problem. They are spreading everywhere like wildfire. And it's, you know, it used to be a problem or a bad thing to be homeless. You know, you were embarrassed, ashamed. There were churches and organizations that would help homeless people out. Now, it's almost a badge of honor. And you live in one of these filthy tent cities and you see a lot of teenagers going that way, you know, like, why should I pay for anything, man? Dude, I can, you know, have a joint and enjoy my life. Why should I work?
Well, you know, I see that the home, you know, you classically see, you know, kind of older homeless people. You see them in their, you know, mid-50s, some in the 60s. You see a lot of people that hold up signs that say they're vets. You know, I don't know if they are vets or not. You know, that's been a scam for a long time that has always really bothered me. I know when I was working for the San Jose Police Department, we had a homeless situation there. And when a person would say that he was a vet, you know, I'd start asking him military-related questions, and they wouldn't know the answer to any of them. And they were very simple questions that anybody in the military would know the answers to. So, of course, that's a scam. But I'm seeing now a lot more younger people that are, you know, holding up these signs and just kind of bumming off of everybody else. These are able-bodied people, you know, people that are young, like you said, Linda, college-age people. I'm seeing people in their early 30s. And the thing that's really bothered me is I've actually seen them holding up signs, help me, I'm homeless, I need work, and they're 50 feet away from a fast food restaurant with a big sign on the front that says we're hiring. You know, I mean, I don't get it.
Well, sure you do, because they don't want to work. Right. But, you know, there's a few facets to mental health, to homelessness, that it's not just one type of person. So I did a little research on this and wrote an article called Lawless Homeless Societies.
And I, by the way, I read the article in America Out Loud, Linda, and as usual, you did a wonderful job of articulating the problem, and I thought you were spot on. What a great opportunity for us to talk about that.
Okay, well, let's do that for a second. What I found out, and I knew this, but I didn't know the exact why, is that, you know, back in the 60s, the California, of course, the leader in everything, right? California started deciding that they were going to release people from the mental institutions and put them in group homes or foster homes, or, you know, you can label them any type of a name, but basically they were group homes, and they were in, you know, not the nicest areas of towns. Right. So they took them out of their kind of safe spaces where they were given medication, you know, on a daily basis, and they were put in for-profit group homes. Well, as these people filtered out of the state hospitals would close because, you know, they didn't have the patients and the money. So as they started deinstitutionalizing psychiatric patients into these homes, hospitals would close, the people would go into the homes, but they were not mandated to stay in those homes. So a lot of them chose not to do so in whatever frame of mind that they're in. Remember, they're already in a psychiatric hospital. They can't think properly for themselves. And now they're out on the street. And they don't have the drugs that they need in order to stay.
Well, the psychotropic medications, sure, which are mood-altering drugs, and they're designed to keep the person stable so they can do normal things. They can take care of themselves. They can, tie their shoes. They can communicate with people. They can work.
Right.
Okay. They can take care of themselves.
And some people never can. That's right. Just the way right. that is. But in 1967, when Ronald Reagan became governor, almost half the hospitals had already closed. And in that same year, they passed a bill, the California legislature, that is called the Lantermann-Petras Short Act, which almost entirely abolished involuntary commitment. So back in the day, people used to be able to be involuntarily committed for, if they were acting crazy. And now it was very hard to do that.
That's exactly right. And every state has some type of welfare and institutions code. In California, it's called 5150. Which we understand. Anybody
right.
that knows what a 5150 is usually comes from California. But basically the elements of that are the person has to be gravely disabled, which means they can't take care of themselves. They have to be a danger to themselves or a danger to other. It can be any one of those things or a combination of all three of those things. And that allows a police officer to detain that person involuntarily and transport them to a mental health facility for psychiatric observation up to 72 hours. And they can even keep them for longer periods of time as long as the person continues to present with severe mental health difficulties.
But they don't become institutionalized like they used to.
No.
Where they can get long-term care.
Exactly.
And a lot of these people just end up in jail cells and then they get filtered back out onto the streets. So what happened after that, just historically, in 1973 in Long Island, in New York, there was a decision made that the ACLU had sued for. The group homes said that if you come into our home, you have to take your medication as you are prescribed it. And the ACLU sued and said that wasn't constitutional, and the judge agreed.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but the reason why the group home would want that mental health person to take their psychotropic medication, their prescribed medication, is because they act out. And there's a lot of times there's violence.
Violence.
They fight with people. They can be suicidal. I mean, there's a whole variety of different types of things that can pop up. And law enforcement officers know this all too well. And so they are trying to look after these people. And by the way, legally, this is referred to as a special relationship. Okay, when you are dealing with people that normally really can't take care of themselves, you form a special relationship with them. So here are these group homes trying to do the right thing, and here comes the ACLU getting in the way, trying to establish constitutional rights for these people. But they have to remember that these people are gravely disabled.
Yes. Yes. And so they did them no favors.
No favors.
What happened was a lot of these people went from a miserable existence in institutions to an even worse existence in group homes to the street. So what we see now, the result of this, all of these years later, is a lot of the homeless people that we all see are mentally ill people. That's not all of them, but it is a very good percentage of them. And they don't have any way of supporting themselves. They don't have any safety net anymore. They have no way of going to get help because they wouldn't even know how to were it available.
They're living in crates. They're living in cardboard boxes. They're living in the streets in sleeping bags and under blankets, surrounded by shopping carts. They're living in fields. They're living in creeks and sloughs and in culverts and under overpasses. They break into houses, abandoned houses. And they live there, and they, start using drugs to self-medicate, and all manner of things happen to those people while they're there, including women that have mental disturbances, mentally disordered women, and they get raped, they get beaten. I mean, there's all sorts of victimization.
Do they bear children?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of victimization that happens in these homeless encampments and in these homeless areas. And I think you were talking about, you know, who's at fault for that?
Well, first of all, I want to say that so the mentally ill in those homeless tent cities are one component, right? Then you have a lot of drug addicted people in there.
And parolees. Right.
And people hiding from the law.
Exactly.
And you have a lot of
illegal aliens.
And you have people that just plain old don't want to work and just think that that's their lifestyle of choice.
And they don't want to follow the rules.
No.
They don't want anybody to have any type of normal control over them. What do I mean by that? Hey, look, it's lights out at 11 p.m. or it's lights out at 10 o'clock. You can't drink in here. You can't use drugs in here. You can't have weapons in here. Right. And they don't want that. They don't want even the most simplest civilized rules. They don't want that. And so they will not go to the shelters. They
right.
will not go to the religious missions and things like that, even though they give them free food. They'll come in and get the food, but then they'll turn around and leave because they're lawless.
Right. So you have a mishmash of all these people and coexisting in these tent cities. And then what happens after that, Ron, is just what you said. The judges and the attorneys get involved, and the ACLU gets involved.
And that's never a good thing.
No. And they start making rules that say, well, you know, that box or that broken down car is their domicile, so now the police can't do anything about it. And they start saying, well, they can stay in these areas, and they can do this, and they can do that. And here's where we are today. We are in a place where regular citizens of a town are walking through urine and needles and feces and who knows what, disease-ridden people that are propagating diseases that haven't been seen since the Middle Ages around here, that we thought were abolished, at least in the United States, like typhus and polio and even measles. And these diseases are coming back because of all of the above mentioned things that we just talked about.
Including flesh-eating diseases.
Yes.
And so you're right. We have typhus, we have hepatitis, we have cholera. I mean, we don't have these things. Now we do, right? I mean, we had eradicated these things.
And these things don't stay within these homeless tent city borders.
No.
They pass to everybody else's children and families. And, you know, the dog brings, you know, whatever home on their feet. Or, you know, there's all kinds of... There was a child that picked up a needle from the street and started sucking on it. What do they know? They're 2 years old. But you also have, again, back to judges and attorneys and politicians who start saying, well, you know, we're not going to prosecute trespassing or vagrancy or burglary or drug offenses anymore. So now it's a free-for-all, and it's become the wild, wild west there because they can do anything they want, and nobody's going to do anything about it.
You know, it's okay to feel sorry for the downtrodden. There's no problem with that. We feel sorry for the downtrodden. It is perfectly fine to sympathize with people that have mental health issues. I certainly sympathize with people with mental health issues, even the violent ones. And I'm going to tell you why, because as a police officer, I saw a lot of violent mental health people. I had to talk them down all the time. I've been attacked by these people. I've been injured by these people. But I also understand, because my background is in forensic psych, that sometimes these people are just off into a different world and they don't even comprehend what they're doing.
No, but they need help.
Okay.
And
doesn't mean we shouldn't be protected from them.
Oh, okay? Exactly. They need help, and we need to create a system again where they can get the help that they need. And, you know, I mean, the article is a little bit long. It goes into all of the things about, you know, what did these judges think that they were doing in the way of helping these people because they helped no one. They didn't help anybody that was homeless. They didn't help any of the citizens in the cities. They helped no one.
You know, Linda, you know, I've told you before, I'm a huge fan of your articles. You know, sometimes I think they're a little bit long, but then when I read the articles, I'll tell you what, you learn so much more. I know you put such an effort into writing those articles, and this one was another a very informative article because you actually give the chronology of the history of how mental health, at least using California as an example, how our system, our mental health system, has just become a shambles. And you're right, California is the leader, and not always for good things. And we see this across the nation now. What we see in California, we see in Washington, we see in Oregon, you see it in Nevada, we see it in Texas, you see it back east, you see it in Florida, you see it in Wisconsin, you see it everywhere.
Where does this stop, though? And you know, it's just such a problem that is blossoming bigger and bigger, and we're doing all of the wrong things. You know, back in the day when police could really enforce the laws, they would move those people out of there and tell them, you know, get a job and do the right thing. And, you know, those things mattered back in those days. Now, I mean, they spit in the officer's face. It doesn't matter. They know that they're not going to be able to do anything.
Well, they
to
do
them.
Worse. They do worse. They attack officers. They kill officers.
Yes.
You know, they injure officers. That's a whole nother story. But I think your comment is well taken. Everybody needs to have a code of conduct. And that's why we have laws. Our laws set up a code of behavior, a code of appropriate behavior, a code of appropriate conduct. And when you are naive, uninformed, and you're a judge, and you're a bleeding heart, and you think you're helping these people, you are not helping these people. You are making it worse for these people. You are hurting these people. And sometimes you are the causative factor of these people's deaths. To themselves, by themselves, and also, at unfortunately, the hands of officers that have to deal with these violent people like I have seen on the job as a police officer. You are not helping. You are making it worse. You need to educate yourself about what mental health is all about, what homeless is all about. Linda, like you said, the various components of homelessness. And I find that they don't take the time to educate themselves, and we all suffer because of it.
Well, we do. And we as the public are suffering because of it, because they have taken over the places that we walk, the restaurants that we enjoy, the entries to our condominiums in our cities. All of these places are being damaged, and how is it that those people's rights are more important than the other people's rights? They just have this all back ass words in my mind, and they need to fix it. They need to start cleaning this up and enforcing the drug laws, moving these people out, and getting the people that need mental health care that kind of care, and stop this situation, and don't allow it to be, and it won't be.
And, you know, don't forget that law enforcement officers are protectors and enforcers of the rule of law. If you destroy the rule of law, then your protectors and enforcers can't help you.
Yes.
Even though they want to help you, they can't help you. They're precluded, they're prevented, they're obstructed from helping you. And so judges and legislators need to understand that. When you make these stupid laws and create these new case laws that empower the homeless, enable the homeless, you make it dangerous for them and dangerous for us. How about our last cup of coffee?
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up the Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
Well, I have a huge frost my socks tonight, Ron.
Okay. All right. Give it up.
Really, this really makes me mad. There is a lady that is 69 years old who works at the United States Geological Survey. Actually, she works in a division of the National Minerals Information Center. She's a statistical assistant. And let me say again, she's 69 years old. And she is a Trump supporter. And she has been being harassed at work for some time. Last February, she put a picture up, a regular picture, not a campaign picture, of President Trump and Melania Trump. And
what, in like her cubicle
or something?
In her
cubicle.
Okay.
And her boss, Mike Magyar, who was the acting director of that portion of the office, wrote her a note. He took her pictures down and said that she violated the Hatch Act. And the Hatch Act says that you can't put campaign pictures up. You can't, during campaign season, you can't have active campaign pictures. Well, this, first of all, that's not what she did at all. This is an official Trump picture. It's not a campaign picture.
By the way, let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You and I have been in many government buildings. And do we not always see a picture of the President of the United States in all of those federal government buildings?
Of course.
Of course. So, you know, obviously that's not a violation of the Hatch Act.
Well, he told her that it was and took them down and told her that she was creating a hostile work environment.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And this poor woman has been in a situation where she brings her food to work with her, puts it in the refrigerator, and it's tampered with all the time. And nasty notes are written. I mean, very nasty notes are written to her and left with her lunch. And I mean, what kind of a work environment is that? That's just absolutely disgusting that because she happens to like President Trump and in her own personal cubicle wants to have a picture with him, somebody at her office, more than one somebody, are absolutely going nuts about this. And this boss came back and actually said that she violated it, and he reported her and had her investigated for violating the Hatch Act.
It's just amazing.
And anyway, what happened was they said, yes, you did violate the Hatch Act.
Who said yes?
Because she had a little I voted sticker
on it. That's where she messed up.
Okay, so she took it off.
Okay.
And that's fine. But the harassment from the coworkers has continued, and they call her vile and vicious names. She stopped bringing her lunch to work, and by the way, she was not prosecuted. She was only warned. But this is what happens when these people have this whole Trump hatred going on, that it makes them insane.
Yeah. Well, I can't really respond because I agree with everything you're saying. And it's just so interesting in just 2 short years how this has evolved. I tell you what, I did not like the prior president of the United States. As a matter of fact, I despised him. And I told you when he got elected, I said, this is the beginning of the end of what we know as America. And because he and his ilk and the people that he brought around him did everything they could, and this is my personal opinion, honey, did everything they could to destroy this nation. And now we have the resist movement, which I am almost positive that
Barack Obama is the man behind the curtain, just like George Soros and all of that, and it hurts the United States of America. And that's a United States citizen that's being hurt.
And
by
she's
it.
A disabled woman of
60. Oh, is she really?
Yes.
Oh, that's cowardly. That's terrible.
I don't even want to read the notes that they leave her because it's just so insulting. And I just feel so bad for her to have to work in
Can
that.
Can she not file a suit of a hostile work environment?
Well,
herself.
I believe that she has or is in the process of doing that now. The harassment to her was finally acknowledged just a few weeks ago, and it's being investigated by an independent investigator. So, you know, I wish her good luck, and I'm just so sorry that that has to happen to anybody. And, you know, these people are the party of tolerance, really?
No, they're not.
No. Well, you and I had the opportunity a few nights ago to do something that we've never done before. It was really interesting. So this came about because our daughter does kind of crazy things sometimes.
She's a little bit weird.
No, she's,
but in a good way.
Yeah, you know, she's
in
fascinating.
A good way. It is.
She gets involved in all kinds of things, and she loves to learn. And so in our community, we live in a rural community,
right.
And we have a nature center in our community, and the nature center once a month puts on a presentation about some sort of wildlife within the area.
And you know, it was my first time visiting the nature center. I've passed it many times on the road and seen the sign, and the other night, like you said, you and I went there with our daughter and our stepson.
Son-in-law.
I forget all these relative things. But anyway, and what a wonderful nature center for a small community like ours. I was extremely impressed by our lecturer.
Yeah, Dave Barkley is a snake expert. I mean, a very serious snake expert within
the
country.
This man knows his snakes.
Oh, my gosh. But, you know, it was really good for us because we know that we live with snakes every day. And we're out way out in the country. We know that, you know, there's snakes out there. And they don't bother us. We don't bother them. But I'd like to know more. And I learned some things that were very valuable. So the thing that he started the lecture with, first of all, he's a very entertaining speaker, was, of course, venomous snakes, which is what we all want to know. Who's venomous, who's not. The things that I have been taught throughout my life about how to distinguish a venomous snake has always been by the shape of their head. The triangular head is venomous, and if they have a rounded head, they're not. Totally false.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I thought I knew a couple of things about snakes, and I was totally wrong.
Yeah.
So this was a great experience for both of us, because like you said, we've got a ranch, we've got a river in our backyard, there's snakes all over the place.
In the water, out of the water. But, you know, the one thing that I didn't know is that a very venomous snake in the form of coral snake lives underground everywhere around us. And I've never seen one, and I didn't even know that they were out there and didn't know that they live underground. Also didn't know that if they bite you, you will barely even feel it and think that it doesn't hurt and it doesn't need medical treatment. But, oh boy, yes, it does, because within about 30 minutes, you will
start
be
experiencing
in big trouble.
Yep, respiratory distress to respiratory arrest, which is never a good thing when you stop breathing. I kind of am very interested about rattlesnakes, because I've shot rattlesnakes before. Rattlesnakes, to be honest with you, they scare me.
And, well, you scare them too, and
well,
that's
yeah, but,
what we
okay,
learned.
So talk about that, because that was so interesting, the way he put it into perspective, where you start thinking like the snake instead of a human being. Why don't you share that?
He talked about a variety of snakes, but they all have this in common. We are far bigger than they are. And snakes, they don't move very fast. Everybody thinks snakes are really fast, but they're not fast. They are actually pretty slow. The fastest snake recorded on a football field has been about, 5.5 miles an hour. And you can certainly walk faster than that. So what you do when you encounter a snake would be to take a step back. But what he said is that snakes, you know, they have a spine, and they're only a couple inches high, right? So They're very low to the ground. So we look huge to them. We look like these big giants from Twilight Zone to them. And they're afraid that they're going to get stepped on. So if you are heading their way, say in tall grass, and you don't see them, they hear you, they feel your vibrations, they see you. And apparently a lot of snakes have very good eyesight, and they watch you, and they look at your eyes, and they look to see if you're looking at them. So I thought that was really interesting. And it makes sense that that snake would be worried that you're going to step on them and break their spine.
And that's why rattlesnakes rattle, to warn you. It's not that they're going to attack you. They warn you and they say, don't come any closer to me. And that's why other snakes hiss very loudly. They open their mouths up very wide and they hiss to warn you, not because they're going to attack you, but they're saying, hey, don't come any farther.
Yeah, hey, I'm here. Don't step on me. Right. Don't hurt me.
And I thought the creepy thing was that snakes are out there. They're all over the place, and they're always watching you. But they are hiding, so you can't see them.
Yeah.
But they're watching you, and they will leave you alone if you are just, you know, unless you're walking right towards them. They will leave you alone. It's not like they're going to come out of nowhere and bite you or something like that.
They're not
going to
come out and attack
exactly.
you, because that's not what they do. What they don't want is you to attack them. And when they think that you're going to step on them, then they feel threatened. And that is when they react. So that makes total sense to me. It actually makes me feel a lot better, too.
Well, you know, getting back to my friends, the rattlesnakes, the one thing that I thought was a couple of things that I thought were very interesting. Number one, 99.9% of the people that get bit by a rattlesnake survive. Now, he said you're going to be in a lot of pain, but you will survive. The other thing that he talked about was, if you get bit by a rattlesnake, you don't, you know, use the rattlesnake kit like they used to give, right? And make little incisions,
right.
and do all of that stuff. He said, and don't suck the venom out, you know,
you're going to drive it into your bloodstream even faster.
Yeah, you're going to just go faster. So he said, just leave it alone and get to a hospital as soon as you can.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. And he did say that if you get bit by a rattlesnake, you will know it immediately because the pain is excruciating, and that you pretty much are in a lot of pain from that one.
And you know, when he talked a lot about the venom and how the venom is made up and how it breaks down, you know, the tissue and the
yes.
skin and all of that, so they can digest the animal that they've bit. And I thought it was really fascinating. He says, you know, when they're hungry, you know, they'll bite something, like they'll bite a rabbit or they'll bite a rat or something, and the rabbit will run all around. The snake will back up after he bites them. The snake will back up and just watch them. And then the rabbit kind of hops away and then it goes someplace and dies. Well, the snake, with a great sense of smell, tracks the rabbit, finds the dead rabbit, and then he goes ahead and he eats that rabbit.
Yes, because it's rare that they eat live animals. And some snakes, like the coral snake, only eat other snakes.
That was, I thought, was very, very interesting. Man, you got to walk around all day until you find another
snake.
I know.
It was quite fascinating. And, you know, I would recommend that to anybody to do something like that, because, you know, the things that we learned are really helpful to us. And, you know, we learned some good news, because we live in a place where there are cottonmouth snakes, which
right.
scare the heck
and we
out
were
of me.
And water moccasins.
Which are the same snake.
Right. And we were pretty concerned about that, right? Because we're down by the river all the time, and I had seen Lonesome Dove, and there's a terrible scene
yeah.
in Lonesome Dove
where
a guy gets killed by a bunch of cottonmouths,
yeah.
right? Water moccasins.
Yeah. Well, what we found out is that...
That's
that,
not true.
That in our county, even though they are in Texas for sure, in our county there has never been... a sighting of one.
Yeah.
So I'm very relieved about that. Of course, my luck would be that we get the first one. But
we're always in the river, okay? During the summertime when it's warm, we're swimming in the river.
They're still not going to bother us,
though. We're sitting in chairs drinking wine or having a beer. We're in the river. We're kayaking. We're fishing. We're doing all sorts of stuff.
And they're out there watching us.
And they are. But you know what? But we don't have them
here in our county. So I was very happy to see that. But you know what I thought was really cool about the Nature Center? Linda, didn't you tell me that they actually have a nature daycare center?
Yeah, nature preschool. And they just teach the kids in a Montessori style of school, all the educational things, but then all kinds of nature things, which I think is fabulous.
Boy, I'll tell you, you know, all our kids are grown. They're all could have kids of their own, for God's sakes. But I'll tell you what, if you had a kid, if we had kids again, that is the kind of place that I would take our kids to go to school.
I think since we don't have grandkids, we're going to have to send the Desi dog over there and see what she can do.
Well, get her snake trained, you know. But isn't it wonderful and a blessing that in our county we have a facility like that?
It is.
Well, Linda, I've got a great story of my hero of the day, and I just want to identify him. He's a tech billionaire, and he's an African-American man, and his name is Robert F. Smith. And he was a Morehouse graduate, and he is the 9th generation in the United States. And I believe he was the first person in his family to go to college.
Okay.
So now, due to, you know, the blessings and his intelligence, he became a tech billionaire. And so he was given the honor of doing the commencement address for this year's graduates, the 2019 graduates of Morehouse College. Now, Morehouse College is an all-black male college, a historic college,
yeah,
historic black college.
Predominantly.
Mm-hmm. And it's in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
And he gave a wonderful speech about how important it is to give back to the community, right? Give back to the community. And at the end of his speech, he said, I am going to pay off the student loans for every member of the graduating class of 2019 at Morehouse College. And people, boy, I'll tell you what, you could have knocked them over with a feather. And that is worth about $40 million.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, what he is a true hero. And this college is legendary for, you know, creating really good people coming out of it. So it must be a really good educational institution. And, you know, I some part of me wishes that it wasn't considered an all-black, that anybody could go there and get education. And I'm sure that they can. I don't know that much about it, but I'm absolutely grateful that the black students are blessed with a place of this quality to go and to, you know, be educated, feel comfortable, and, you know, just get a really good quality education. God bless this man for sending them on their road into life, you know, a little bit less burdened.
And what a great role model Robert F. Smith is. And I'm hoping that the students take something from this as an important and critical life experience, and they
pay it forward.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, that's the name of his program. It's called Pay It Forward. And I hope they do that. So I hope they use their degrees to give back to their community and then do something, maybe not as magnanimous as Mr. Smith did, but I hope that they continue to donate to Morehouse College to help their brothers and sisters that are in their community to go out and excel and help the black community. Well, I am pretty much done for the evening. Are you ready to hit the sack?
Let's go push that Desi dog right out of the way.